record, not a video of this. So please identify yourself and your client for the audio record. With that, Mr. Bray, are you prepared to begin?
I'm prepared to go.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Bray, and I represent appellant Emily Anik in this case. The two things I really want this court to come away with after oral argument is this. Number one, it is respondent's burden of proof to come forward with undisputed facts relevant to the applicable law. And here, Your Honors, I would submit that the respondent wholly failed to do that. What I want to point out is that on the issue of whether this relates to his opinion that appellant Emily Anik is a vulgar person or not, he never stated that it was his opinion. So the court relied upon what apparently it inferred would be his opinion if he was asked. He never did so in discovery. He never did so in any declaration or affidavit of the court, and he did not do so during his deposition. So I would submit that for that reason alone, the respondent failed to carry its burden. Secondly, with respect to the defamation opinion line of cases, I would submit that this factual scenario is distinct from that line of cases, and it should not have applied here. Now, going on to the facts, I have to concede that the trial court did a pretty decent job of outlining the facts. I'm not going to quibble with those facts, but there are three things I'd like to leave you with. Number one, that the appellant was temporarily employed with the state, but she was going to be offered a permanent position as laid out in the factual background if she had not been terminated. Number two, that she was terminated as a direct result of Mr. Bonsante's claims to the appellant's direct supervisor, Heidi Reller. And number three, there was no one else in this meeting room except for the appellant and the respondent. We should be able to put some more flesh on the bones of this case rather than rely on conjecture from the trial court as to what Mr. Bonsante's opinion would ultimately be. So I think it's appropriate to put this back to the district court for additional findings, and it should go to the finder of fact to determine whether whether it was really Mr. Bonsante's opinion that Emily Anik was a vulgar person, and two, what actually took place in that meeting room between the two of them. I think that those are important factors to take a look at on a factual inquiry. Now, first I'm going to address the opinion line of cases. The respondent claims that the opinion cases apply to appellant's claim. I submit that those cases do not. First, there are no facts in the record that the respondent offered, as I said before, to suggest that the respondent's opinion was that Emily Anik was a vulgar person. He specifically said, in fact, that she used the F word during this meeting. And the fact that he used a number of symbols to describe what was obviously a vulgar word being used. There's no other word that really fits in that sentence except for the F word.
Can I ask you, Mr. Bray, excuse me, when you say that the record shows that he reported that she used the F word.
Well,
it went to Mr. Martin or to Ms. In other words, are you sure that was that he used it to the two? Is it Martin and then Reller? Is that the right name?
I might have
the
names wrong. You're correctly referring to them.
Okay. I know what he said in the deposition that she said. I'm wondering whether he conveyed to either of them that F word.
I believe so, but I can only offer my own conjecture. I think we need to put, as I said, more flesh on the bones.
No, I'm asking not for conjecture. I'm asking for what the record shows. Okay. I think you said that the record shows that he conveyed that she used the F word, but I don't know that the record shows that she conveyed to either of those.
I believe it does. I think the only reasonable inference from the email that was sent from Mr. Bonsante to Ms. Reller was that was the word that you take to be put in that sentence.
Okay, if you
take
a look at the sentence, if we just look at, I just want to be very clear, because part of the issue here is using like euphemism. So let's hear exactly what was said. So I think that he talked generically to Mr. Martin about vulgar language, I think. And then he sent the email to Ms. Reller that used ampersand, exclamation point, et cetera, used characters.
And in fact, his testimony in the deposition was that he spoke to Ms. Reller. She responded to his, she asked him to send the email as a follow-up to her. He excluded that portion of what he claimed was the factual background of what happened. She said, why did you leave out the vulgar language? And so then he put that in there. And it's pretty clear. I mean, it's pretty clear to me. I'm as a native speaker of the English language, and I don't want to infer or suggest that you're not. But the only word that fits in there is the F word. So that's my response to your question. So going on, he never says, Mr. Bonsante, that is, in Judge Larson, that's the correct pronunciation of his name. So he never says anywhere in the record, gee, it's my opinion that she's a vulgar person because she used vulgar language. If that was the record, I might have a little bit more trouble with respect to if he offered an opinion that she's a vulgar person. But he did not say that. He didn't say that anywhere in the record. Therefore, I think this needs to go back to the trial court as to be in front of the finder of fact, to flesh that out, so to speak. Second, if you've read those opinion cases appearing in the court's order and cited by the respondent, none of them are really like this case. The court cited McGrath versus TCF Bank, which is a Minnesota 1993 case, in which the plaintiff was called a troublemaker by the defendant. Well, yeah, I agree that that's an opinion. It's not certainly that's subject to something verifiable. You can't make a finding that somebody's a troublemaker. It's an opinion. The other case is Turner versus Wells. And that's a Florida case, but it did collect a number of cases from Florida and other jurisdictions talking about the word unprofessional as an opinion. I would agree with that. That's also an opinion. It's not something that you can verifiably make a fact finding concerning. So again, that's not like this case where the allegation is that she specifically used the F word during a private meeting. Also, that they cited, the court and the respondent cited this Meyer versus Moretti case, and that's a Pennsylvania case from 1995. And that arguably is more similar to this factual scenario. In that case, you had an employee talking to another employee on a telephone and allegedly used the F word, was reported and terminated. Well, in that case, the court inferred that that was his opinion that she was a vulgar person. I don't think the reasoning is very good. And I don't think that Minnesota should adopt that case law and bring it into this jurisdiction, A, because it doesn't make sense. B, it is determinable based upon verifiable facts. So Minnesota law requires that something be verifiably found as a fact before it falls into the opinion line of cases. And that's the case here. The allegation that she used an F word is verifiably fact findable, so to speak. So we should be able to go in front of the fact finder and have them determine the credibility of the witnesses, have them determine whether one of them is not telling the truth and the other one is.
What if the email instead, because what matters for the defamation is what he communicated really to Ms. Reller, right?
Right.
I mean, that's a defamatory statement. What if it said, and she told me she would, paren, vulgar word omitted, quit and not come back? What if instead he wrote that? What does that do to the case?
I don't think it does anything to my case. I think if you take a look at that sentence, again, the only word, the only vulgar word which would fit in that sentence is the F word, followed by ing. So I would submit that doesn't change the case really at all.
even though it would rely on his opinion of what vulgar language was. It's because it's the only natural word that he could be referring to, you're saying?
Right. I'm saying that. And also, whether using the F word is vulgar or not, I don't think it's subject to much debate. I mean, I think all of us here would conclude, and I think the general public would conclude, that that's a vulgar word. It doesn't, you know, walk on the fence, so to speak. You know it is. Just as a matter of common usage. And if
what
I could...
What about the question of, is there a disputed fact relative to malice? To get to the respondent's argument that in any event, it would be barred by qualified privilege.
Thank you for going there, because that's the next place I was going to go. The trial court was correct on that issue. The trial court found that there are fact issues related to whether the qualified immunity applies. It did not address my multiple arguments, even before you get to whether there's malice. And I would submit that you can find those particular arguments. There are four or five other elements that you look at before you even get to malice as to whether the qualified immunity applies. But the court correctly found that there was potential malice here. And the malice consisted of, and you get a dose of small town politics here, the appellant's husband was once the mayor of 50 Lakes. And Mr. Bonsante enjoyed frequenting the municipal bar in 50 Lakes. And he got himself in trouble on a number of occasions in that bar, getting into a fight on Mother's Day in 2018, being cut off in a number of circumstances, allegedly getting ready to throw a beer bottle at the bartender who he didn't like. And he appealed to Timothy Anik, the appellant's husband. And Mr. Anik, I think, correctly noted, I'm not getting involved in this. It's the bartender's call. They're on site. And if you get cut off, if you get kicked out of the bar, I'm not going to intervene. And that may seem petty to a lot of people. But again, that's a small town for you. It happens. And the respondent was quite upset with Mr. Anik with respect to that happening. It was even the subject of a city council meeting. Which goes to show you know, how interesting those might be. But again, I think the court was correct in its findings of fact by finding there was a fact issue concerning malice, but also as to whether the qualified immunity would even apply here. There's a case, I can't remember the name of it, but it involved a shoe company. And there was an allegation that one of the employees was stealing shoes. And that person was summarily dismissed after kind of a company meeting. There was no investigation. And similarly here, there was no investigation. What the qualified privilege does, it allows you to conduct an investigation without the fear of being sued for defamation. Okay. There was no investigation in which to communicate something that you would like to communicate. So the communication, the defamatory communication, was not part of an investigation. It was, you know, the direct cause of her termination with no investigation. She was given no opportunity to discuss her side of things or to deny what happened. She was simply terminated. And right before she was about to be hired as a permanent employee. So I do get into greater detail in my responsive memorandum to the respondent's motion for summary judgment. And there are several elements I address, and I think I did all right. So I would refer you to that. And so there is no other reason, no other basis to say that the respondent would have been entitled to summary judgment on the basis of the qualified immunity or with respect to the opinion line of cases. And I would submit this matter should be remanded back to district court for additional factual findings. That's all I have, unless there's other questions. Well, I'm glad you're tired from the earlier cases. You guys asked a lot of questions in those cases. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Goodwin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Michael Goodwin. I'm with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I represent Mr. Bonsante in this matter. Your Honors, there are two independent reasons why this court should affirm summary judgment in Bonsante's favor. First, the record shows that Bonsante's statement was made in the context of reporting and investigating employee misconduct, and this court's case law establishes that the statement was therefore qualifiedly privileged. Second, the district court correctly found that Bonsante's comments about Anik's use of an unspecified vulgarity and lack of professionalism were matters of opinion and therefore not actionable as a matter of law.
So, Mr. Goodwin, can we start on that latter question? It sounds like the professionalism question is not really in front of us. What if I'm looking at the email that went to Ms. Reller, and I will use the word effing to refer to the word F-U-C-K-I-N-G, so we know exactly what we're talking about. We don't have to use euphemisms. If it said, if I didn't get it, me, a few others would just effing quit. Is that an opinion?
If that's what the email said, Your Honor?
Correct.
If it used the actual term.
F-U-C-K-I-N-G. If it spelled it out, it didn't use those little symbols if it spelled it out. Is that a matter of opinion anymore?
It's not a matter of opinion as to whether the word was used, Your Honor. In the case where F-U-C-K-I-N-G is spelled out, obviously that's not this case. The only
why is it so obviously not this case? Besides the fact that the letters aren't there, is there any other? I think the argument is it's not a matter of opinion when the only natural inference from those characters in context is F-U-C-K-I-N-G.
It's not this case, Your Honor, because the Minnesota case law is very clear that the actual defamatory statement must be set out in the complaint. That's paragraph 4 of this complaint. And the only statement referenced in the complaint is the email. There's no indication from the record that either Mr. Martin or Mrs. Reller inferred that it was the F word or that the actual F word played any role in their decision. Ms. Reller's statement.
I'm trying to get at the opinion. I mean, the that this is an opinion, that it's an opinion. That's not why it's not defamatory. And I'm just trying to understand the difference between spelling out F-U-C-K-I-N-G. As a matter of fact, she said a few others would, F-U-C-K-I-N-G, quit, versus a few others would just characters. When is that, you're saying it becomes an opinion because you have to infer what the characters mean? It becomes an opinion?
It becomes an opinion, Your Honor, because it was characterized as vulgar. And then he used the symbols. If we're talking about defamation, the actual word is necessary because we need to, and the reason for that is because you need to parse the actual statement, not what was inferred from the statement or what could be inferred from the statement, but the actual statement. And there's
If he had written instead the way people sometimes do, she said a few others would just effing, E-F-F-I-N-G, quit. That's used a lot of times to mean F-U-C-K-I-N-G. But you're saying that still would be an opinion because it's not quite the actual word?
Well, in that case, Your Honor, there's no guesswork involved as to the actual word. Here, you do have to do some guessing as to what the actual word was. And Your Honor, I think that...
What, counsel, what other words do you think it could be?
Well, Your Honor...
I mean, because I do think there's something to appellant's statement that as normal people conversing in the English language, that you can sort of read the email and read between the lines what they're saying.
Well, Your Honor, I guess that's the whole point. What words could they be? That's the reason for the specificity requirement, so that you don't have to do any guesswork as to the.
I'm submitting that I don't know that it could. I guess I'm not convinced yet that it could be something else. And I guess, has there been evidence put into the record that it might mean something different?
No, there's been no evidence at all as to what Ms. Reller or Mr. Miller thought it was. And that's what matters. I would also say that making this case entirely about the F word kind of misses the point. The point of Mr. Bonsante's communication was to communicate that her tone and demeanor were unprofessional. He didn't even mention the vulgarity until he was prompted by Ms. Reller. And if you look at what Ms. Reller, then the decision that Ms. Reller made in her affidavit and in her letter communicating the end of Ms. Anik's employment, it's because her tone and demeanor were unprofessional, which was used, which she had been counseled on numerous times. So, Your Honor, I don't think whether the F word was in fact used at the end of the day really matters. I think making it about the F word is just kind of ignoring the context. As the court said, it's really not at issue here that calling somebody unprofessional or characterizing their tone and demeanor is anything other than a matter of opinion. And so I think the opinion line of cases applies cleanly as to those statements. I do want to talk about qualified privilege, Your Honor, because I think qualified privilege is dispositive in this case, and it's an issue that Anik didn't bother to brief for this court. It was raised in our notice of related appeal, and so it is properly before the court. But appellants waived any argument to the contrary by failing to brief it.
Well, they didn't respond to it. I mean, I think that we decided this is not really a notice of related appeal. It's just an alternative basis to affirm summary judgment. And so you would naturally be the first party, I think, to raise that. And then there was no reply brief. Is that correct?
There's not a reply brief, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so that's where the waiver comes in. To the extent the court reaches the merits, I think if the court looks at the McBride case, that's the case where the Sears employee was accused of stealing. What the court said in that case is that, you know, when we're talking about an inquiry into employment misconduct, that sort of subsumes the proper occasion and proper purpose analysis, because the employer has an interest in those kinds of communications being freely made. As to reasonable cause, remember the defendant here is Bonsante. He is the speaker. And so as in Hunt and McGrath, two other cases that deal with qualified privilege, because he was talking about his personal observations, there was no requirement that he himself do an investigation, because he's the one that's doing the reporting. To the extent the investigation issue matters at all, well, Ms. Reller did do an investigation. She talked to two supervisors. Mr. Martin's characterization of the conversation is in the record. It's Exhibit C to his deposition. And then she prompted Mr. Bonsante.
So let me ask you, Mr. Goodwin, if this were a case, and we'll make it simpler, that the email in fact says that what he told Mr. Martin, let's say, and then what he subsequently told Ms. Reller. So he offered it first to Mr. Martin and then told Ms. Reller. Let's say, you know, taking different facts different from this. And both occasions he said, she said she would effing quit. Okay. So, and she says, I never said that. He says, yes, you did. Does qualified privilege apply to that employee in this, who reports that when there's a factual dispute about whether the person in fact did what the reporter says that the person did, when there's just the two of them?
Sure. Qualified privilege does apply in that instance, Your Honor, because qualified privilege applies regardless of the truth or falsity of the alleged defamatory statement. If it
but if there's just I understand when that applies when someone's relying on someone else's false statement, you in good faith rely on that. But why would it apply to a defendant who would knowingly make a false statement? They were there and they know it didn't happen. Wouldn't that be enough to get you at least to trial on whether that's malice because you lied to the other people and said that someone said something they did not?
No, Your Honor, because the qualified privilege, I mean, the qualified privilege applies to the speaker as well. If qualified privilege turned on whether that person's report was true or false, then it would just be subsumed within the it would be subsumed within the element of the claim, because falsity is an element of the claim, and so there wouldn't be a qualified privilege for speakers such as Bonsante, who are reporting something in the chain of command.
What's the case? Is there a case where the person who's seeking qualified privilege is the person who's actually reporting firsthand testimony about what they observe someone do or say?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's both the McGrath and the Hunt case. In both of those cases, it was a number of managers in McGrath who were reporting that Mr. McGrath they were reporting their observations of his work. And then in Hunt, similarly, the person who allegedly made the defamatory communication was a coworker and made the observation based on his personal observation of Hunt's work. So I really think it those are the cases that when we're talking about a statement made by we're talking about the statement of the declarant where personal observation matters, those are the cases.
Counsel, I think the district court distinguished those cases based on who the initial communication went to. Can you, just because, you know, agency hierarchies can be confusing, could you just briefly I just want to make sure that I'm understanding sort of the chain of command correctly. Like, Martin is within, I'll just let you answer the question before.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. So Martin, Bonsante, and Reller are all supervisors at DHS. Ms. Anik was supervised by Ms. Reller. Mr. Bonsante, she asked Mr. Bonsante if she could talk to him about this case, even though they're not in the same chain. And then Bonsante went to Mr. Miller to actually address the argument, or actually address the issue that Ms. Anik came to him about. And in the course of that conversation, they had a discussion about her use of vulgar language.
Bonsante and Martin are peers.
Bonsante, Martin, but yes, that's correct.
They would be peers, and Anik is not a direct report to Martin. It seems to me that that's the distinction the district court was making, and why. Right, that it would be one thing if the way this went down is conversation happened. Your client went directly to her supervisor, reported it, said, this happened, it made me really uncomfortable, et cetera, et cetera. She investigated it. That's sort of the line of cases you were just talking about. And the district court is saying, well, this is slightly different because first what happened is he went to his peer and said that she said this. And after reporting to a peer who's not a direct report, he said you should go to her supervisor. Why is that? It seems to me you think that's a distinction without a difference. And I guess what's your support for that? And your time's about to expire, so you can certainly answer my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think it is a distinction without a difference. But even before we get to the distinction without a difference, It's the report to Mr. Miller is not at issue in this case. That is not the allegedly tortious conduct. The allegedly tortious conduct, as explained in paragraph 4 of the complaint, is the email to Reller. The report to Miller, I think where the district court went wrong is it kind of went off in a direction that nobody really briefed and talked about the report to Miller. The report to Miller, I still, to the extent it's at issue at all in this case, I still think is qualifiedly privileged because you've got two supervisors coming together to talk about how to respond to, one, an issue raised by Ms. Anik, and two, an issue of employee misconduct. That brings this into the McBride and McGrath line of cases. And I think that's why the district court was just respectfully incorrect about how it analyzed the qualified privilege. I do see that my time is up. I'm happy to answer questions about malice, but otherwise I would just ask that this court affirm summary judgment.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bray, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, I can't do this without standing up. I'm just gonna offer a few bullet points. The respondents suggest that the issue of the correct chain of command and the need to know communications was not briefed. That is not accurate. I briefed that in my responsive memorandum. And what I believe the case was McBride. And what it says is that if you're looking at an investigation, it's got to be the people obligated to perform the investigation in the quote need to know unquote category. I don't know where Mike Miller falls, or Martin, Mr. Martin, I think it's Martin. I always get his name wrong, falls in that category. There was no allegation, no facts put forward by the respondent that he is in the need to know with respect to disciplining somebody who he didn't supervise and didn't work with. The correct response would have been not for Mr. Bonsante to go to his golfing friend, he said he socialized with Mr. Martin, but rather go to her supervisor first, and then a proper investigation was done. I would submit that under the McBride versus Sears case, I believe that involved a shoe salesman who was alleged to have stolen shoes. That falls under that case where the court determined that that was not a proper investigation. And I would submit here, the same thing occurred. There was no investigation. She was simply summarily terminated. So
I think the argument about briefing, Mr. Gray, I think is that you did not submit an appellate brief.
Oh, on that, reflecting that issue. But the record contains that litigated issue. And I don't believe the rule pertaining to reply briefs requires me to respond to new issues. I have the ability to and the discretion to do, and I chose not to. So I don't think that argument's waived. It's already in the record, and the trial court addressed that issue. So I think it's fair game to talk about it here. There was no allegation, like I said, in the record that Mr. Martin was in the need to know. And I think that just as my final point here, respondent attempting to dance around whether the F word is relevant or not, and because it wasn't specifically spelled out, it could not form the basis or the factual basis for a defamatory claim. I think the case law does not reflect that. That's a bit pedantic, and I don't believe there's any case in which that was stated. They do state generally that you have to state with specificity whether what the defamatory language was, and that was the subject of an earlier motion to dismiss. I made an oral motion before Judge Askegard to amend my pleadings. The court granted that, and I did so, and there was no further motion to dismiss on the basis of the lack of specificity about the factual background of the defamatory statement. So I presume that that had essentially been a dead issue, but apparently not. I think there's enough facts in there, and certainly you can infer what the word is, and that's the basis of her termination. And so I believe she's got a cause of action. And what we would like is to go back to trial court and have a trial before the fine people of Crow Wing County. And that's it. That's all I've got, unless there are any additional questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ernest.
Thank you both for your arguments in this case. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in this matter within the time prescribed by statute. With that, we have completed our calendar for